You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to Deep Cuts, a periodic feature of The Dirt that we aim to do monthly, where we dig in a little deeper on a topic from our main feed, saved just for you, our wonderful patrons. Thank you for your support.
Yeah, thank you. This time around, we're talking horses. I'm a horse girl now.
Yeah, so we, this is relevant, we promise. We discussed horses in our veterinary medicine episode, in which we mentioned Kikuli and his plan to turn that horse around, get that horse swole. As we mentioned there, Kikuli was a Mitannian horse trainer who worked for the Hittite palace around 1345 BCE. And we also mentioned that his equine fitness plan was part of a larger corpus of texts known as the Hittite horse training texts. So, to quickly summarize the Hittite hippology texts, that's very difficult to say.
Isn't it?
The first is the Kikuli plan, which we don't know whether it was written by Kikuli in Hattusha, the Hittite capital, or if it was written by Kikuli back in the land of the Mitanni, where he was from, or if it was adapted from a guy named Kikuli and just named for him, or something else entirely. So we don't know anything. Yeah.
So the Kikuli plan is like, is it Brussels sprouts? You know, like, they're not from Brussels. Why are they called that? Or
Jerusalem artichoke.
There we go.
Neither an artichoke nor from Jerusalem. Anyway, following the Kikuli text, there's hippological instructions with a ritual introduction, which is known as the Old Hittite horse texts. And then the New Hittite horse texts, just known as hippological instructions, parentheses, Hittite. Just some homegrown horse wisdom from your horse uncle. Now, we would love to read more of those to you, but they've only been published in German, and we don't have the translational chops or hippological vocabulary auf Deutsch to handle talking about Pferden. But as a treat for you, dear listeners, we're including in the notes to this episode a link to the catalog of Hittite texts, or
the CTH.
Look, I had real tea instead of decaf tea this morning. I'm on a tear. Section E of is hippology, where you can click on each respective text and see a line-by-line translation from Hittite to German. And for everyone, you can click on a little camera icon to see images of each of the tablets. So even if you can read neither German nor cuneiform nor Hittite, you can at least get a sense of what Kikuli's disciples would have been working with.
Isn't that cool?
That's very cool.
Yeah, it took some sleuthing, but I found it.
Good sleuthing.
Thank you.
You used your horse sense.
Now, let's move on to another very different set of Hittite texts.
We're no one-trick pony.
What?
I'm just trying to pepper in some horse puns.
I think you said we're no trick pony.
I said we're no one trick pony.
Okay. All right. It's just like no tricks here.
Nay.
So the laws. The Hittite laws were first written down in the early Old Kingdom. So Old Hittite Kingdom. So yeah. That's between 1650 and 1500 BCE.
There's a weird decimal point here.
I know.
16.5 BCE.
16.5 centuries ago.
I mean, yeah.
Four of the many copies of the laws are in Old Hittite, and the remainder are copies made during the Middle Hittite or the New Hittite periods, which would have been from 1500 to 1180 BCE.
May I ask a question? Does the language change significantly? Like, is Middle Hittite, does that simply refers to the chronological period, or is it like Middle English versus Old English, where it's difference in language?
It changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I don't know Hittite, but
that's fair.
My understanding is that It also, you have to think about, it's rendered in cuneiform, so it's not just a language written down. It's something that they would have cleaned up how they render it. So something
it's not really
so something that happens in Akkadian over time is they get more streamlined in how they render it in cuneiform. So early Akkadian is very much like use of logograms, adding every single part of a word. Whereas in later and sort of the latest Akkadian,
you figured out their workflow.
Well, no, you just, they get kind of lazy and it's hard to tell how. So like if you, do you see this a lot in languages? Like you see this in classical Greek, where by the time it's Koine Greek, it's kind of lazy. It doesn't have the specificity and it doesn't have all of the case endings and all of the very formal aspects of it. And this is also something that's part of Semitic languages. So like the way that you would have like spoken Arabic versus modern standard Arabic versus classical Arabic. It's in terms of how much stuff is rendered in it. And so just like with how Hebrew doesn't have vowels unless it specifically has vowels. And that's usually something that is a much more formal religious text. So it's that sort of thing.
Well, the religious texts don't have the vowels. The Torah doesn't have vowels.
Okay. Well, you know, you have... You have the types that do and the types that don't. So that's part of, so it could be something like that. So it's not so much that the language is changing, but the way the language is represented.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But we're still dealing with, you know, like 600-700 years. So it's probably changed.
Yeah. Okay. I was just curious whether the old versus middle was a designation just chronological or also related to the language. Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to horses.
Yeah. And so the old Hittite copies of the text of the laws are characterized by a more archaic form of the language and a form of cuneiform writing that is typical of the Hittite Old Kingdom. So that would have been whatever they had really like first adopted from other cuneiform using societies. Only one new Hittite copy actually attempts to revise the laws. So they're just sort of recopying them otherwise, and they just modernizing the language of the old Hittite copies.
Okay.
So they all say basically the same thing, except for this one law, this one set of new Hittite laws that kind of went rogue. and so I'm going to quote from law collections from Mesopotamia and Asia Minor here, which is a fun book. It's
okay.
A fun book from my grad school days.
Couldn't tell from the title.
Okay, you have to. Okay. Actually, you could get a, was it a minor? Was it designated emphasis? I think it was a designated emphasis in like ancient law. It was like really dumb. That's something you could do at my old school. Quote, the laws are formulated in what is known as case law. The condition, if a person does such and such thing, is followed by a statement of the ruling. He shall pay whatever shekels of silver. Someone shall be put to death. They shall something him or something similar like that.
Ominous.
Yeah. This manner.
See our upcoming Dirt After Dark episode.
Yeah. This manner of formulation is one of several types of formulation found in the laws of the Hebrew Bible and the Mesopotamian law collections. No laws in the Hittite collection are expressed in the second person. That is, you shall not do such and such thing. Although such a formulation can be found in texts of a legal nature outside the law corpus, such as treaties or loyalty oaths. So if you've read the Codex Hammurabi, that's something that's like a lot of them begin like Sha Awilum whatever. So if a man, whatever.
And then, if then it's just a series of clauses.
Yeah. And now
I'm very excited. Treat me to this.
And now, dear listener, we arrive at the anecdote that made me want to do this episode altogether. A very specific Hittite law about, shall we call it, romance and its consequences.
This summer, from Nicholas Sparks.
The Hittite laws. So Hittite laws, they deal with a lot of stuff around like there are sections that deal with like property damage and and sort of recompense for that, things like fraud, theft, and then they get into sexual offenses.
Yeah, I see you've eased me into this here.
Yeah, so this is Hittite Law and Order SVU.
Dun, dun.
So law number 186. Whoever buys the meat of 2 yearling cattle shall give 1 sheep. Whoever buys the meat of 5 weanlings shall give 1 sheep. Whoever buys the meat of 10 calves shall give 1 sheep. Whoever buys the meat of 10 sheep shall give 1 sheep. Whoever buys the meat of 20 lambs shall give 1 sheep. If anyone buys the meat of 20 goats, he shall give 1 sheep.
You can get a lot for 1 sheep.
You get a lot for 1 sheep. Law number 187. If a man has sexual relations with a cow, it is an unpermitted sexual pairing. He will be put to death. They shall conduct him to the king's court. Whether the king orders him killed or spares his life, he shall not appear before the king, lest he defile the royal person.
Boy, it went from 1 sheep to... They went from 0 to 60.
If a man has sexual relations with a sheep, it is an unpermitted sexual pairing. He will be put to death. They will conduct him to the king's court. The king may have him executed, or he may spare his life, but he shall not appear before the king.
But he will go to court.
He'll go to court, yeah.
But not to the king.
So the thing that I remembered is one time in grad school.
Law and Order SVU.
SVU. A thing that I remembered from grad school was one day in my like readings in Assyriology like class or whatever it was, we were in the middle of this absolutely painful class discussion because I don't think anyone had done the reading and there were like 10 of us. And my friend Eduardo was like, so we were talking about the Hittites and we were talking about sexuality and like discussions of homosexuality in Hittite law and society. Mm-hmm. And we were basically talking about how this was a really bad article and the article had a really bad take because it was framing homosexuality as something in opposition to heterosexuality. Whereas, but that's taking very much a present Western lens onto it. And so we were talking about how sexuality and gender and power dynamics and all of the things that factor into sexual relationships are very different and very much rooted in one's own society. And so we were talking about this among the Hittites. And so things like how it's... how you could say with a man or a woman, like sexual relationships with a man or a woman, like it didn't matter because they were both there. And like, that wasn't the thing that was taken issue with. And my friend Eduardo is like, yeah, so you could definitely have sex with a horse. You just like couldn't show up in front of the king. And everyone's like, what? So it just like took this like, left turn. And so, our professor, who was she's like a MacArthur genius, was like, interesting. Yes, that's right. In the law corpus, it's like talking about how there are animals that one can have sex with and one can't, and how it's not actually a problem.
You just can't then go tell the king about
it. You just can't be in the royal court or in front of the king or a priest. And
because you will sully them. What a day you had.
And it was the weirdest day of school. And so that's why I wanted to do this entire episode. It's from that time that Eduardo like completely ground our seminar to a halt by bringing up Hittite laws about having sex with horses. Okay. Now, listeners, in trying to find more about this badly remembered anecdote from grad school, I sent Anna in search of accessing a copy of this article entitled Hittites, Horses, and Corpses on Bestiality and Necrophilia in the Hebrew Bible.
Thank you.
Presumably got her put on a list.
Probably. Still haven't cleared my browser history.
And alas, it yielded nothing. But nevertheless, I persisted.
Bless you.
Continuing with this thread of man's special friend, horse, I looked to the book, The Rise of Bronze Age Society, Travels, Transmissions, and Transformations by Christian Christensen and Thomas B. Larson. And then Anna, I want you to read the caption on the, these two this figure here, and then describe what we're seeing in the two images.
Figure 149, bronze statuette of stallion-human relationship from Anatolia, parentheses after Bittel, 1976, end parentheses, and a Scandinavian rock art depiction of a similar relationship, photo, Thomas B. Larson. Okay. Top image is a man, it's a bronze statuette, as the caption says, of a man standing, and in front of him is a horse rearing up with the horse's front legs are on the man's shoulder, and the man's left arm is up, kind of, you know, they're hugging.
It looks like they're in doing a middle school slow dance.
Yeah. Yeah, there is room between them, but also the horse is very much a stallion. His stallionness is quite evident. And then in the bottom image of the rock art, you know, it's rock art, so it's sort of stick figure-y, but there's the image of a man on the right with his arms up in the air like, ah! And then what is presumably a horse, also very much a stallion. Unless that's a third back leg. And the horse has, I guess that's his mouth open. It's like he's going, buddy. That's kind of cute.
It's like stick figures.
Yeah.
They're stick figures. Figure so horse. It's a horse like
freaking horse, out. Kind of. Yeah. a horse going like, nah! And then the guy going, ah! And they love each other.
Yeah. So, there's not an embrace in that one as much as not there in the second bronze one, statuette.
And so now they're just really happy to see each other.
They're just really happy to see each other.
I think that's kind of cute.
I found it very cute. And so now I'm going to read from The Rise of Bronze Age Society.
Please.
And this is beginning on page 324. So
follow along, readers.
This is the section entitled Royalty and Horse Sacrifice / Copulation. Hierogamy. So hierogamy being like a hiero meaning like religious or holy, cultic.
Yeah.
And gummy meaning marriage. So. Man-animal relations can be seen as important parts of rituals and myths during the second millennium, and the horse had a prominent position in certain regions, certainly in Hittite and Vedic society, and in the Nordic Bronze Age. Owing to this central role, horse rituals were linked closely to royalty during the earlier to mid-second millennium BCE. And here's going to be a quote from Puvel, 1988. The Indo-European pattern of theriomorphic hierogamy... Theriomorphic hierogamy.
Shapes.
So, holy
beast
copulation
shapes,
with like beast forms. Okay. The Indo-European pattern was clearly king and mare. The Near Eastern and Mediterranean one being queen and beast, remember like the Potnia Theron that you learned about in Archaeology 101.
Master of beasts.
And so the examples being Europa, Pasiphae, and the wife of Archon Basileus copulating with bulls. The Roman Leda. Women, what?
Leda and the swan. Also,
well, yeah,
that's beast shapes, not horsey.
Like swans
beasts.
Aren't beasts. We're talking about mostly bulls, or like Roman women ordered to cohabit with Faunus's he goat. That in Indo-European tradition, the basic myth sanctioned pattern was rather man and mare is made likely also by the Hittite law code.
Hey.
Unlike the sweeping injunctions against bestiality in sources such as Leviticus 20:15, the Hittite code expressly exempts from punishment men having intercourse with presumably female horses or mules. After sternly meting out capital punishment for such behavior with cattle, sheep, and swine. Remember, I read that about cows and sheep.
Yeah.
And your mom? Not specifically your mom. One's own mom?
My mom. My mom is great. Leave my mother out of this.
The only reservation is that the perpetrator does not become a priest, which seems to anchor the practice squarely in the warrior class, that is, among potential candidates for kingship.
You can't, then that disqualifies you from priesthood.
Yeah, specifically the horse or mule.
Okay.
The similarity to the man stallion. So now I'm back to Christensen and Larson. The similarity to the man stallion relationship, as expressed by the two scenes in figure 149, which Anna helpfully described to us, is obvious.
Yeah, well,
even if there were formal differences between the two compositions, man and horse embracing each other and man and horse greeting each other. The main purpose with both representations must have been to put emphasis on the bonds and unification between man and horse stallion. Bronze Age Scandinavia and Anatolia shared parts of a mythological or religious context where man-horse relations were important. Within the framework of an almost pan-European emergence of social stratification and the development of elites and warrior aristocracies during this time.
Oh, aristocracies.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So that, and then it goes on from there. But if you think about what all these places have in common, and there also are the you also have this in Celtic Britain. There's a like sort of mythological, like semi-mythological or kind of like stand-in relationship between the queen and a horse. Mm-hmm. And so what do all these places have in common? You've got like Hittite Anatolia, Scandinavia, Vedic South Asia, Celtic Britain and Ireland. What did we talk about in
Did you want an answer? Because I do know.
Yeah. What's the thing in common?
Indo-European stuff.
Yeah. So they all have Indo-European languages. And so is this part of Indo-European culture? Like horse stuff?
Yeah.
Is it?
I mean, that is kind of their thing. I don't have an answer.
It kind of seems like that, which is another. See, this is why I have been like chomping at the bit, as it were, to talk about this.
No, it's really cool. I just don't have an answer for you.
Yeah, because like, it's something maybe that has been like consistently relevant to episodes we've done lately. Mm-hmm.
Well, just a brief dip into archaeology then to close this out. There are other references to ancient horsemanship. Amber, would you like to read your lovely joke? Oh,
but not a horseman ship.
Yeah, so this is pulled from an article, a special article in the Equine Veterinary Journal from 1990. And it reads like an article from 1990.
What?
Well, you'll see.
Okay.
It just, like, to me specifically, it's got some language that would have, like, if this had been written within the past, you know, 5 or 10 years, that language might be a little bit different. I don't know. It just sounded very 90s to me.
Okay.
Or very like.
So
very,
it's like, oh, this was gnarly.
Something, something hot topic. I don't know. And also the parts that I excerpted are interesting specifically to me because my training is in faunal analysis, but also there was some interesting stuff from kind of a horse raising logic perspective that I hadn't considered because I've never raised horses, although I grew up down the street from a horse farm and was babysat by the owners of that horse farm.
It's like and, five horses.
I was babysat by a herd of horses. Yeah. Yeah. So I was around horses a lot, but I didn't really think about the logistics of raising them. Anyway, so quoting from this article, which is by D.F. McMeekin, or McMeekin maybe. Although horses once roamed Eurasia, by the Neolithic period, herds were depleted by not climactic changes. that's a different horse manship. Herds were depleted by climatic changes. No. Pull it together. Forest growth and human hunters. Herds did, however, survive on the Iberian Peninsula, the Eurasian steppes, and the perimeter of forests in Germany, Scandinavia, and Britain, where they were still hunted, along with deer, wild boar, and elk. Horse meat may well have been preferred by hunters. It is sweet because of its high glycogen content, perhaps adding a predatory pressure on the species. Dietary sugar is commonly sought by hunting cultures and markedly improves endurance in man. There's that 1990s language that I was.
Horse meat is sweet.
Yeah. And it's, I think a lot of it has to do with their like fast twitch muscles. And they're, you know, they're running animals.
Yeah.
And
so, it tastes like a thing that runs a lot.
Yeah. The first horse taming tribes were most probably from the Eurasian steppes. Around 4000 BCE, a colder climatic shift occurred here. This favored horses, which, being large, long-legged, and able to forage in snow, were better adapted to cold than most domestic or wild herbivores. An abundance of wild horses led to the emergence of a horse-breeding culture, the Srednistug. But these are hard words for me.
These are hard words.
Okay, so the Srednistug are, this sounds like me trying to do a Swedish chef impersonation. These successors of the Dnieper Donets inhabited the Dnieper River Valley around between 43.
Do you want to start that over?
Yup. I might just leave that in, though. It's just like, just so you know, I tried. These successors of the Dnieper Donets inhabited the Dnieper River Valley between 4350 and 3720 BCE, where there is evidence of a sudden increase in the number of horses at their sites at Derevka and elsewhere in the eastern Ukraine. In the middens at Derevka, 74% of animal bones were of horses. That's pretty significant. The Srednistug possessed the tools to exploit these resources, flint knives, axes, spears, arrowheads, and antler and bone implements. The dramatic increase in horse remains at Derevka, the predominance of colts and skeletal differences from wild horses, are all evidence of domestication. See our Funna with Fauna episode.
Yeah.
Hunting would usually result in a greater kill of older animals and tend towards a predominance of mares. Colts are more likely to have been culled from domestic herds, and in those herds, you keep the mares alive because they're the ones having baby horses.
So I have a question for you, fauna expert.
Oh, boy.
So hunting would usually result in a greater kill of older animals and tend toward a predominance of mares. I understand that if you're like breeding, what you'd be doing is like killing the young colts because they would
usually
be
the male ones.
Yeah, yes. They'd be a pressure on resources that you need for the ones that you get secondary resources from, and that sort of thing. So would it be, but why would there be a predominance of older and female? Would it just be that
females are smaller typically?
Okay.
In species that tend to be sexually dimorphic, so the males are quite a bit bigger and tend to have sharp parts that can hurt you. Not in horses, but like in deer and things like that.
Okay. So,
but males are bigger. You go after the females because while they are still adult and have a lot of meat on them, they're not quite as big and scary.
Okay. They're just easy. They're easier to get. So older ones are easier to get because they aren't getting away from you. And females are easier to get because they are a sexually dimorphic species. Okay.
And
I
older
just,
might just mean, not necessarily like old, older might just mean adult.
Okay.
Like not, you don't go after the colts or the, you know, the young, because first of all, there's not, they're small, so you're not going to get as much bang for your buck, as it were. But also, yes, older animals are going to be easier to chase down, but in general, you see more adults.
Okay.
If these are hunted animals, and much fewer juveniles, whereas if it's a farmed population, a domesticated population, you'll be seeing evidence of culling where you see a higher percentage of younger animals.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Colts are more likely to have been culled from domestic herds. Thank you, article. In addition, ritual entombment of both horses and dogs was found at Derevka, indicating their importance for herding, presumably the dogs.
Aww.
I guess you can herd with horses too.
Oh my gosh. They're just herding them in the afterlife.
Get into groups.
Yep.
I bite your hawks. So their importance for herding, hunting, and possibly for raiding other settlements. Among horse remains at Derevka were found perforated antler tines, considered cheek pieces from bits, as in bits like horse tack. Often found in pairs, these imply that horses were ridden. Riding is necessary for horse domestication because with herds grazing on an open range, control is needed to prevent the usual migratory dispersal. Men on foot, even with dogs, are no match for horses. I'm assuming that they mean in terms of distance and speed. Otherwise, men on foot are a pretty good match for horses in terms of like hunting them or getting them.
Even with dogs.
Even with dogs.
Riding dogs.
That's when I first read that sentence, I was like, did they mean they were riding that? No. Okay. You're an idiot. Okay. Archaeological evidence of the dispersal of horse taming consists of pieces of harness, pictures, buddy, figurines, and horse burials of the so-called Kurgan culture, which we mentioned recently. When did we mention that? Just now. It was like two episodes ago.
I feel like we talked about it with the Indo-Europeans.
Yeah, but well, we did because you asked me about the tombs.
We talked about
in Bulgaria.
In Bulgaria. And then we talked about Kurgan culture, I think, when we talked about historical linguistics. Like, I think it was
yes,
the Indo-Europeans.
Yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Because that's
yeah.
Our girl Maria.
Yes. Who's about to.
Yeah. I was foreshadowing.
Up. Ah, thank you. Cheek pieces of bits have also been found at sites from Switzerland, Transylvania, and the Volga, dating from the 3rd and 4th millennia. This is. Sites Maria Gimbutash. Hello. Highly specialized and successful nomadic equestrian economies flourished from 2000 to 500 BCE, especially the Scythians and Sumerians of Eurasia. Not Sumerians,
yeah.
But Sumerians.
I realized when I said Sumerian recently, I definitely did not specify for folks that it's not the Sumerians.
Cimmerians.
Cimmerians.
And so the Scythians and Cimmerians are distant relatives of the Shredni Stog. I must be pronouncing that wrong.
I'm sure.
Also, Turco-Mongolians far to the northeast of the Altai Mountains adopted the horse.
That's nice.
This led eventually to centuries of nomadic expansion, territorial conflict, and migration. In historical times, devastating invasions of Scythians, Cimmerians, Mongols, Huns, and Turks brought to civilizations of Eurasia not only the horse, but the powerful recurve bow of bone and wood and hit-and-run tactics of warfare. And then this last bit is on riding technique, because that's, you know, who was the first person to say, I'm going to try sitting on that guy. Right? Like, among many other questions, like, that looks like food. I'm going to eat that. Or just like,
I'm going to get on that horse.
First thought to milk a cow. Yeah, like, I'm going to get on that horse. Although few ridden horses are depicted in the monumental art of Egypt, this skips ahead chronologically, and only a single instance occurs in Homer's Iliad, written accounts of riding do appear in the 2nd millennium BCE. A Mesopotamian fable of the 3rd dynasty of Ur refers to horseback riding, citing Gordon, 1962. Riding is mentioned, too, in correspondence of the kings of Mari. In 1700 BCE, a court official, Badi Lim, cautions the king against riding horses, saying, quote, let my lord ride on a chariot, or indeed a mule, and let him honor his royal status, end quote. Although equids were ridden in the Near East, mostly they were asses and various hybrids more often than horses. Horsemanship of the time was apparently not adequate for cavalry maneuvers. Riding there was based on methods used for oxen and asses, which they controlled by a ring through the nose. Mesopotamian plaques from 2000 BCE depict horses and onagers with reins to a nose ring, ridden astride but well back towards the rump. That sounds uncomfortable. With this, quote, donkey seat and no bit, control is minimal. Yeah, no kidding. A figurine on horseback from 1550 BCE and illustrations show the same insecure seat. What were they thinking? Like, I'm going to sit on this horse, but bad. There is also evidence of riding in Egypt, a horse from the tomb of Senmut from 1500 BCE, around the same time, was equipped with a saddle cloth of linen and a leather girth, which is the bit that goes around the horse's tum-tum. Oh. For a long time in the Near and Middle East, horses were regarded as an exotic and foreign animal. Yeah, this is why I pulled that paragraph, because that's something that I hadn't thought about, which is... So I think of, when you think of horse riding, you think of a bridle and a bit. usually, because the horses' mouths are very sensitive. They have teeth in the front of their mouth, but no teeth sort of way in the back. And so the bit goes past the molars. And when you pull on it, the sides of their mouth are very sensitive. So they feel that, and very, you can control them much more easily than with a ring through the nose and like sitting way back on the butt. That just doesn't make logical sense to me.
It makes sense if that's how you rode oxen.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, I don't have the right context. Like, I am used to seeing horses ridden the way we ride them now, but thinking about what seems to me to be a very impractical way of riding, I'm literally putting the horse before the cart. Like, I'm thinking of horse riding from modern perspective backwards, rather than thinking of it from other animals were domesticated before the horse. And so methods of guiding and riding them would have been sort of the logical step.
Well, and actually something that I'm including in the notes that we don't really have time to talk about today is something else from a recent episode, from our Haas and Lu episode. I had mentioned that Anna Medvedskaya had written a lot when she wrote about who destroyed Haas and Lu. She was looking at a lot of like hippological evidence. And there's a really great article from, you guessed it, Expedition Magazine from the Penn Museum about horse gear from Haas and Lu. Because this Haas and Lu was much closer to the like heartland of horsemanship. And so here, about 600-700 years after, well, up to somewhere between 6 and 1,000 years from what we just talked about. So from the third dynasty of Ur up through like, 1500-ish BCE, that's a while before, but also quite removed from what's happening at a Haas and Lu, where they do have bits and bridles and cheek pieces and like really, really gorgeous stuff. So I'll include that in the show notes so that folks can take a look at that to see that sort of horse technology was not
horse tech.
Yeah. Horse tech.
.gov.
It was very, very different in different places. And so this is clearly something where people, as you see a lot, that it's not so much a diffusion of culture or technology as it's people figuring stuff out in very localized innovations.
Multiple times people are like, I'm going to sit on that horse.
Yeah. Yeah.
But why? I guess if you see a cult, it seems much more feasible than if you're just looking at a giant horse going, yeah, totally.
I find horses very frightening.
They're big.
They're very big and very strong and very
but they
nervous.
Got soft noses.
They do have very sweet, soft noses.
There's a horse that lives on a, he lives in a field, but he's outstanding in his field. On a walk that I usually take around where I live. And I've nicknamed him G.I. Joe, the G.I. standing for gastrointestinal, because he's very gassy. but when I go for walks, I like to walk by his field. And if he's there standing by his fence, I go pet his nose.
Aw, I do that with dogs in my neighborhood.
Different experience.
That's what I do with Merle. He's basically the size of a horse.
That's a big dog. Yeah. Well, I think with that, we'll put this episode out to pasture.
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed this, listeners.
Thank you for your support.
This is an anecdote. 10 years. It's been in my head for 10 years.
Well, thank goodness you let it out.
Yeah, now maybe I can forget.
Seems unlikely. Yeah. Thank you, listeners, for your support. It means the world to us. It lets us do what we do, and we love doing this.
Yes, so, we sure
thank
do.
You, thank you.
Thank
and
you.
And we will be back. We will be back soon with some non-horse material.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're done with the horses.
Yeah, and we've got some cool stuff planned. So
yeah, as you all know.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Bye. Right.
Goodbye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.